Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu Chat Club, dem Podcast des London Speaker Bureau. Mein Name ist Roland Festring und ich leite das London Speaker Bureau in Deutschland, Österreich und der Schweiz. Das London Speaker Bureau zählt zu den international führenden Referentenagenturen mit insgesamt 20 Büros weltweit. In unserem Podcast stellen wir Ihnen unsere Redner in einem persönlichen Gespräch vor. I'm going to switch to English now because I'm absolutely honored and thrilled to now speak to one of the world's best Formula One drivers ever, David Coulthard. A very, very warm welcome, David. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I'm not sure many of the purists of motor racing would say I was one of the best ever, but I'm very proud to have competed in Formula One, which in my mind is the top level of motorsport in the world.
Absolutely. And we're going to discuss that in more detail in a minute. But the first question actually I wanted to ask you is, you grew up in Scotland chasing sheep, probably joining your father, who was a farmer as far as I know, joining your father on a tractor. So how did you actually develop your passion for speed?
Yeah, well, growing up in the southwest of Scotland, as you say, is a farming region. And actually, the family business sort of grew out of farming into some local distribution of the milk products that were on the farms, and then into a more national level distribution company, which has been in the family business now until the point where my brother is running that company. My parents are retired and currently sitting on a boat in New Zealand somewhere, avoiding the winter of Europe. And the real hook and the reason why I got involved in racing is my father had been Scottish karting champion when he was 14, and he'd been supported by his father, who was very much into horse racing, motor racing, all of those good speed related sports that involved horsepower. But sadly for my father, his dad passed away when he was 14, and his mother wasn't supportive of his career. He was sent off to boarding school, and he had a fairly miserable time there as a dyslexic young boy man. Came out of that experience not very academic, but having thrown himself into further sports. So there's the champion of champion sports elite year is in Latin is called the Victor Laudorum, and my father was winning this two times as a track and field athlete, and then inherited the family transport business when he was 21. Had this great drive towards sports, and that drive and experience in sport allowed him to grow a business and make it more successful, have three children, along with my mother, of course. And all of us were given the same opportunity to have little go-karts around the transport yard, still in the southwest of Scotland, and then motorbikes and all that sort of good stuff that you can do in the countryside. My brother wasn't interested in racing. I was, and my sister was. So we both raced, and I was able to win the Scottish Championship and then the British Championship and then progress into cars, and where Jackie Stewart, a three-time world champion, comes on the scene and was recognizing the sort of progress I'd been making, and invited me to join his son's racing team, which was called Paul Stewart Racing. And the rest kind of grew from there. So it's a bit of a fantasy journey of not really being, planned in the way maybe a Max Verstappen of modern era, where his father was a Grand Prix driver, or Lewis Hamilton, where, his father was absolutely driven towards supporting Lewis, towards being a Grand Prix driver. But I'm a generation or so ahead of them. But the support of my family, both my parents, enabled me to rise up to one day becoming a Grand Prix driver.
But your father apparently was very supportive and supported your career from the very beginning, apparently, because if I thought of my father telling him, well, I want to be a race driver, then he would have said, are you out of your mind? Get yourself a decent job first, or do a training job. Your father never said that?
I think it was more clear for my dad. I started racing at 11, which was the earliest you could race at that time. I won the Scottish Championship within a couple of years, and then progressed down to race in England in the British Championship, and my first year in that was fairly average, as you learn the greater competition. But then I won the following 2 years, the British Championship, and my father just was absolutely convinced, because we'd sit down when we weren't at races to watch Formula One on television. And he was convinced I had the talent to be a Grand Prix driver. So I remember when I was about 14 or 15, him saying to me, when you get to Formula One, not if, but when, then, you know, I think you should do the following things. And, you know, he said Monaco would be a good place to base yourself, because that's where a lot of the drivers are based, for various reasons, of course, one of them being financial, but logistics and training. And he also said that if you're lucky, you'll have a 10-year career. So you should consider, like James Hunt, who was a Formula One world champion, who then went on to work for the BBC in the UK. He said you should consider working in television beyond your career. So when I actually look at my life journey, I did become a Grand Prix driver. I managed to be a driver for 15 seasons. And then I started to work for the BBC. And here I am 14 years later, still working in broadcasting, having started a production business with two partners, who Sony now own 30% of our company as one of the largest growing sports production businesses in Europe. And it's been an incredible journey. And, you know, here I am talking to you, reflecting on what's been a whirlwind of, you know, challenge and overcoming adversity, of course, success, failure, near-death experiences. It's been quite a journey.
Well, and apparently Dad's expectations were met and his predictions were pretty precise.
Yeah, he obviously is very proud of that. You know, I must recognize the great support I had from my mother as well. But again, it goes to show that if somebody has belief and confidence, it doesn't mean that, of course, it will happen, because there's many ways it could have not happened. But with a belief and with a commitment, then you just keep coming back from all the knockbacks. You know, you just keep going forward. And I think it's a great education in mental strength and desire.
Touching back on your career, so when you were actually a Formula One driver, you were basic in competition almost with one of the legends, Ayrton Senna. I think he just passed away 3 weeks before you did your first Formula One race. But for quite a number of years, you were competing with Michael Schumacher, another legend, apparently. And this is what I was saying in my introduction, one of the greatest race drivers of all times are you, but it was definitely kind of very, very difficult to compete with those kind of guys. What kind of relationship did you actually have, first of all, towards Ayrton Senna? Was he a kind of an idol? Was he very special? And then, of course, your direct competitor for years, Michael Schumacher.
Well, Ayrton, of course, was already a legend of the sport when I was in karting and watching his winning his first Grand Prix, I think, in, was it 85, in Estoril, then going on to be a multiple world champion. Alain Prost was always a driver that, let's say, was kind of my favorite. I always admired a very efficient driving style, very smooth. And I know that's quite a, you know, divisive thing to say, because it's like modern era. You're either Max Verstappen or Lewis Hamilton. Very rarely do you see someone really appreciating both. But there's no question Ayrton was one of the best drivers in the history of the sport. And I found myself as the Williams test driver working with three world champions. First of all, Nigel Mansell in 92, then Alain Prost in 93. And then for the beginning of the 94 season, I was the test driver for Ayrton. So I spent time with him at the test track. I saw how he worked with the engineers, as I had with Prost and Mansell. He was, you know, an incredible, fast, dedicated, precise, I would say kind in the way he dealt with the mechanics and the engineers. So, you know, he maybe had this slightly, not aggressive, but very assertive. Let's say the public view of him could be he was you know, very assertive and almost bordering on aggressive, but I didn't see that. Yes, in his driving on track, we can see he was very committed, and when he decided he was going to make an overtake or challenge someone, there was no hesitation. But in the way he worked with his team, he understood the power of team. He understood the power of every individual within that team, were playing a part in building a car and supporting his challenge towards being on track. And they quite literally had his life in their hands. So that was a very interesting education to see that. And then ultimately he had told Frank Williams that he thought I was a good test driver and he thought I had potential to be a Grand Prix driver. And that, you know, he very much supported me being given that opportunity in the future. So fast forward to May 94, sadly, Ayrton is killed on the Sunday at a race restart. We'd lost Roland Ratzenberger, a brilliant young Austrian, on the Saturday. So it was a very dark weekend for Formula One because we'd not had fatalities for many years in Grand Prix. And that affected a change, a quite rapid change in the way the governing body, the FIA, would look at safety and how they would work on the strength of the cars. And it also, of course, meant Williams needed another driver. And as a test driver, I was given that opportunity. Now, I couldn't replace Ayrton, of course, because he was one of the true greats. But what I could do was give 100% in his honor. And that's my approach. And, you know, a couple of years later, I won my first Grand Prix, which was a decade after he'd won his first Grand Prix in Estoril. So there's been many sort of links to the journey and the handover from, sadly, Ayrton's death to me starting. And of course, his great adversary at the time of his life was Michael Schumacher, who became one of the most successful drivers in the history of the sport, winning 7 world championships. So I was competing against Michael and my teammate Mika Häkkinen through that era. So it was a pretty tough time to be a Grand Prix driver, to be racing against such fast and committed drivers. But I always wanted to compete at the highest level to find out how good I could be. And I think that when you compete against drivers of that level, you dig deeper than you ever imagined. You go on an emotional roller coaster, much, you know, with higher peaks and lower troughs than you ever thought you would experience in your life. And at the end of that journey, the moment when I was able to win Grand Prix and have Michael and Mika standing beside me on the podium were real, you know, overwhelming senses of achievement, because that those days were few. But when they did happen, it really made me feel that I'd achieved a certain goal, which was to compete at the highest level. So, you know, obviously tragic circumstances that sees Michael not able to function in public life today. But, you know, in his son, we see, you know, his name continuing to compete or be part of Formula One. And there's always, with the improvements of medical science, the hope and belief that one day we'll see Michael re-enter public life.
Yeah, but how frustrating was it for you, virtually never becoming a world champion competing with Michael Schumacher? It must be very frustrating because he works at absolute top level, but there's always kind of this inch. He either had the better car or he probably was the better driver, more committed. I don't know how you describe it. How frustrating was it? And how would you actually describe it out of your perspective?
Very simple. I'm not frustrated at all. And this is something which is interesting to me as well, because you don't know how you're going to feel about something until you feel it. But I admire success. And Michael was successful his entire career. He was successful in karting. He was successful in the lower formulas. You know, he really blew the doors off Formula One when he did his first ever race for Jordan in Spa in Belgium. He never actually managed to complete one racing lap, but he qualified 7th, which was something quite remarkable in that time. So when you see commitment and speed and talent like that, I'm not jealous. Jealous is a horrible emotion. You know, I'm a competitor. I'm someone that wants to work to improve my entire life. I've always tried to be better at what I do. And in the end, we all come up against someone that's a little bit better. Even in Michael's journey, there was a point in his career where he came up against someone better, because there is a journey, you know, a little bit like what goes up must come down. The only time you never see the come down is when somebody retires at the top of their results. Which has happened in many sports stars. But in the case of those who stay around a bit longer, time stands still for no man is the expression. And, you know, Michael in his 40s was not as complete as he was in his 20s and 30s. And that is not a slight on him or you know, to try and devalue his greatness. He was one of the greatest Formula One drivers in the history of the sport. I am very lucky to have raced at the same time as someone as great as that. And therefore, I sleep very well knowing that, first of all, I was lucky enough to be given that opportunity. I was smart enough to work to create that opportunity. And this life journey has been just incredible. What a way to live your life when you can, you know, be judged on the world stage as to what your level of contribution is. So I sleep very well, and I admire those that have had that last little bit of talent.
So now, when you follow Formula One, I have to admit, I never was a huge fan. I always followed a bit, but I never really was a huge fan. But there's always, as a spectator, you think, well, he had to pull out again, so he's not a good driver, or the other people have the better cars. So it really, I guess it really needs two. You have to be a very, very good driver, and you need a very good car. Or is it to a certain extent possible to compensate the one with the other?
The car is the most important factor, because without a great car, you'll never be in the position to win a Grand Prix. You can always have the, you know, one driver winning one race. And with the greatest respect to, say, Ligier, Olivier Panis won the Monaco Grand Prix in 1996. You know, that car was not the best car. Olivier was a very talented driver, but they did a great job on that day. And I think there was only four or five finishers, and they won the Grand Prix. You count the winners at the end. But I think that the car is always the backbone of the potential success of the driver, and then the driver makes the last little difference. Very rarely do we ever see two greats in the same team, like a Prost and a Senna would be a great example of that. You know, very often you have a lead driver and then another lead driver in the other team, and that's where the big rivalries are coming. But this is not a pure sport in sense of it's just human against human. In physicality, it's still humans against humans, because brain power designs and builds the car, and then the sports person gets in behind the wheel and drives it as quickly as they can. So even with this modern era, with all the technology we have, people are not going out of fashion. We still are the ones that drive the technology and design and build and then deliver that to a driver.
But then the driving style apparently makes quite a difference as well. This apparently there's very, very aggressive drivers. How would you describe your own style of driving?
Well, I think I was a smooth driver. I was not someone you would see sort of car flying around all over the place. You know, Gilles Villeneuve back in the 1780s with Ferrari would be seen as someone quite aggressive. There's various other examples. Ayrton Senna was quite, let's say, an aggressive driver in comparison to Alain Prost. But you always have to hustle the car a little bit. But the reality of a Grand Prix car, it's a inverted aircraft. You know, it's like a jet fighter, but on wheels. And the faster we go, the more downforce we generate. But the downforce is dependent on the wings having a stable airflow over them. So if you're in an aircraft and you go through turbulence, we're all familiar with the aeroplane shaking and the wind. A race car is the same. You might not have the same level of shaking because you maintain a positive contact with the tarmac. But when the airflow is disturbed over the wings, you have a varying level of downforce and therefore potential. So at that point, you may see the car moving a little bit more. But we're not rally cars. We're not, you know, cars that are designed to move a lot and use that movement to be able to, you know, encourage the car around the corner.
So when you would invite me to drive with you from Monaco to Nice or whatever, what kind of driver are you then in a normal car?
Well, I think I'm one that gets a move on. I wouldn't say I was a fast driver on the road, but I don't sit there, you know, meandering away from the traffic lights. I never understand, you know, people who do that, other than they may be really, really trying to hit their record fuel economy, in which case I suggest they take a bicycle and then they will get absolutely, you know, zero emissions. But if you're driving a car, I think you should drive within, you know, the rules and regulations, get a move on and not hold people up. So I would say I was very conscious of other road users. You know, if somebody's coming up behind me and wants to go faster, no problem, I'll move over. And I would feel that I would like to imagine I'd be offered the same courtesy. But what is quite scary actually is when you see the world today and there's so many different people, of course, from so many different backgrounds, you just need to be walking in on the streets or trying to walk through an airport to see how unaware people are of those around them. So it's actually quite amazing that somehow on the roads, you know, tragically, there are many accidents on the roads, but it's actually amazing there's not more accidents, because a lot of time people are just completely in their own little world. And of course, you're not on the racetrack alone. You're definitely not on the open road alone.
And how, in all honesty, how many speeding tickets per year do you get?
I haven't had a speeding ticket in a long time. I did an event with AMG Mercedes on behalf of Laureus Sports Awards. Maybe, I'm going to say 7-8 years ago. I need to check exactly, but it was the Gumball Rally. I went from London to a place in Germany, Euro something it's called. It's like a big Disneyland style venue. And just at the last part of that journey, I was in a nice AMG C63. I was pulled over doing, you know, 10 or 20 kilometers an hour more than what the speed limit was on the motorway. Fair enough, the limits are the limits, and I paid the fine and continued my journey. But other than that, in the UK, which I don't spend so much time, but I'm actually talking to you from the UK today. I'm going up to Scotland for Christmas and New Year. I haven't had a speeding fine in decades.
So it sounds like you're a very, very disciplined driver. Do you actually ever engage a driver, somebody that drives you, or could you stand up somebody else driving you?
No, that's probably the reason I've not had a parking, a speeding fine in such a long time.
That's the good UK, excuse.
Yeah, in the UK, very often I have a driver around London because I'm here for business, and it just traffic and just inefficient to be sitting in traffic, not doing anything. But if I'm in the passenger seat, I can be on my laptop, I can be making calls. So I wouldn't really be a long distance driver. I do it more when I go and visit the family in Scotland. Longest journeys in France would in the south of France would be going from Monaco to Milan for the Italian Grand Prix. I've driven once to Barcelona for the Grand Prix, which was 5-6 hours, but largely speaking, I fly everywhere and then have a driver at the other end.
And you rent Learjets and you fly around the world?
Yeah, occasionally I'll be, you know, on private aviation, if that's the most efficient way. But the rest of the time, you know, I've got to say that certainly for the longer flights, there's very good service from Nice to Middle East, first of all, Dubai, or to New York from Nice. So if I'm trying to cover East or West, that's covered. And through Germany is a great connecting hub for either via Munich or Frankfurt.
Yeah, well, I'm referring to the year 2000, I think it was, when you actually survived a plane crash in a Learjet.
Yeah.
Must have been an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, it was a life-changing experience, of course, because there I was taking a flight from an airfield just outside London called Farnborough. An hour later, we have an engine failure, left engine. Nearest airport is Lyon in France. We start an emergency procedure, although a single engine landing is a completely achievable procedure. And then after maybe 30 minutes of coming into the final approach, the pilot made three times the worst mistake you can make, which is being too low and too slow, because when you have only one engine, you should always have at least a little bit more speed, because you've got less power, of course, and you definitely don't want to be too low when you have less power, because you have less maneuverability. The co-pilot had apparently on the voice recorder told the captain three times, "You're too low, you're too slow." But we all make mistakes, and sadly that mistake had tragic consequences, and the pilots were both killed. And myself, my girlfriend at that time, my trainer at that time, were able to climb out of the wreckage and, you know, look back on what was the remains of a Le 35. So that was a Tuesday before the Spanish Grand Prix. And I traveled by road that afternoon, having managed to be released from the whole sort of customs procedure, because our passports were still on the aircraft. So, you know, we couldn't show our passports quite clearly to the police. But after a bit of a procedure, we were released, and I was driven back to Monaco that evening from Lyon. There's a lady called Petra Schleuning, who worked for Daimler for many years. She was very involved in the organization of, you know, vehicles and Formula One, and she was incredibly helpful and efficient in making sure we could get back to the south of France. And then I had some decisions to make. I had to decide. I had cracked a couple of ribs, and I had to decide whether I wanted to continue being a racing driver, because that would involve flying. But very quickly I decided that, even though out of the tragedy, I did want to race, and I wanted to continue, and I wanted to continue straight away. So I was entered in the Grand Prix and finished second to Mika, my teammate. And the journey continued. But it definitely was a life-changing experience, because, you know, I was approaching 30 years old, or I'd just turned 30, and you get a little bit spoiled. There's an expression, I think it was Bill Gates, that said, success is a lousy teacher. It makes people think they can't fail. Well, it's not just a lousy teacher when it comes to failure. I think success can be a lousy teacher, because, you know, the word spoiled, where you expect this and you expect that. Well, that's not a healthy place to be, expecting anything. You know, you've got to remember your manners. You've got to remember how lucky we are, and how life is not necessarily 3 score years and 10, or whatever the average age is. It's through fate that.
Yeah, but if you say this was a life changing experience, what did you actually change in your life?
Well, I stopped being a little bit spoiled, let's say. So I wasn't like, get me this, get me that. I became, I think, more focused on really how lucky I was to be a Grand Prix driver, and it focused me back 100% on driving, on how do I be a better driver, where life was becoming full of boats and planes and parties and all the good things that come with success. You know, doors suddenly open when you're in that situation. So I then started to be more focused on making sure that physically and mentally I was properly prepared, and I wouldn't allow anything to distract me from my goal.
I think most of the people who are listening now would think this is extraordinary. You're surviving a plane crash, and 3 days later, you're sitting in a racing car again, yeah, and even becoming number two. Yeah. In the Grand Prix. Most of us, most probably, would say, Jesus Christ, I just survived a plane crash. I need to rest for a week or two, and I have to go to wherever and relax. So how did you actually get focused that quickly and to even almost win the Grand Prix?
I've got to imagine, if we go through the history of human beings, if we go back to a point where you needed to get on with things to survive. We didn't have all the modern facilities that we have today, you know, electricity and heat and communications and everything. I think that as we become more comfortable in the world we live in, we become more, oh, you better take some time off, and you better, you know. I think that society has become, let's say, softer in their approach to how we deal with events. And I think in sport, if you look at how quickly sports people recover from injuries, one, because they have really good support, no question. They have good doctors there. But when it comes to a bone healing, a bone is a bone. So why does the athlete heal more quickly and get back on the football field? Desire, hunger, continuing to train the other parts of their body, even when they cannot train the leg that is broken. Where modern society would say, oh, you've got a broken leg, we're going to put it in a plaster cast, and you should go and stay home for a month, and people go home and sit and watch television, don't do anything. So if that was a broken bone 200 years ago, they weren't having a plaster cast. You know, they might have understood to tie a couple of sticks to the side of the leg, but they still had to fight for their survival. So I suspect that if they survived the broken leg, they would have healed more quickly because they would be, you know, still active and still doing things. So I think that sport, not because sports people are mentally better or mentally stronger, but they just have a very clear focus on what they want to do. And I think in normal society, a lot of people do what they do because that's what they do, but it's not their passion, it's not their desire, and therefore it's not their hunger. I think that having passion in whatever you do allows people to, I'm maybe not explaining this very well, but if people who own their own business, who own a shop selling newspapers or magazines, whatever it happens to be, they don't tend to take many days off because they're sick. They tend to work because it's their business. People who work for others notoriously will take, and in some cases much more, will take time off. And quite often in Britain now, you see if it's a bank holiday Monday, people will be sick on a Friday because then they get Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. The person who owns their own business is not doing that. So it's just society. People become successful in business, not necessarily because they've got more academic skills, but maybe because they've got more desire, they've got more hunger, they've got more need for whatever reason. And I think sport is just an extension of that. And it's just filmed. If we filmed successful business people, there would be something, a common thread there. And it isn't always based on their academic results. Quite a lot of people that would be seen in society today at a high level never finished their college or university degree. They dropped out. So they don't have the qualification, yet they have success because they've got work ethic.
Now, I think that brings me to another interesting point, because people who are very successful very often are perceived to be arrogant because other people envy their success. And as far as I remember, you were perceived, in particular in Germany, to be rather arrogant. And of course, that probably may generate or originate in the competitionship with Michael Schumacher. First of all, before you answer the question, I have to say, you are the most charming man I know. And whenever I meet with you, I think, Jesus Christ, he's so friendly, so down to earth, not at all arrogant. What did that actually do with you? That of course, you know, because you're a public person, how your perception in Germany in particular was at that time. Would you say, I don't care, and probably even prove the fact that you're arrogant? Or what did you actually think about it?
Well, it's interesting because the reality is I didn't really think about it because, of course, I'm not German. I don't speak German. I've had a long relationship with Mercedes-Benz. You know, I won their first race in the modern era in 97 in Melbourne, Australia. I still have a relationship with them today. I'm a customer. I'm an AMG ambassador. My father bought Mercedes. You know, it's been like a perfect dream journey for me. I have an old 1971 280 SL, which is the same year I was born. I have a 1984 G-Class convertible. You know, I love the brand. So even if I had never driven for them, I still would have been part of that journey to whatever level I could have afforded. And incredibly loyal, I have to say. You know, German business, German people, incredibly loyal if you've been part of a journey with them. So I've got tremendous respect for that. I never realized that I was perceived in a certain way in Germany, because my job was to drive the race car quickly. My job was to develop the race car, was to try and extract the maximum I could. I wasn't feeling like I was a politician trying to get a certain amount of votes so I could do my job. So as long as I had the vote from, you know, the boss of Mercedes and the boss of McLaren, then I got my signature on my contract. That was the two most important people that needed to believe in my ability to contribute to the team. So a much smaller lobbying group than if you're a politician. But I worked in retirement for UBS when they were a global partner. And I remember one of their executives saying to me, I have to tell you that, you know, we've become friends now and we get along and we like each other. But I have to tell you, when you were a Grand Prix driver, I thought you were one of the most arrogant drivers And I was really surprised because I never realized.
Not only in Germany, worldwide. Yeah,
and in Switzerland as well. I just never knew that that's how I was perceived. And maybe it's partly the media of how they tell the story of Michael's success and anyone who's coming against Michael. And, you know, Michael and I occasionally crash together. And maybe it's the way I answered questions. I really don't have an answer for it. I think I've always been the same, let's say. But of course, there's periods of your life where if everybody's telling you, yes, 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 like in my late 20s, then you get used to people saying yes. And maybe you start to act in that way, which is where I think the plane crash really brought me back down to earth, quite literally. And it made me remember the values that I was brought up with and the commitment that got me to that point. And I just wanted to focus 100% on the opportunity that was there for me. So that is what led to, the 15-year journey. And who I am today is just a 51-year-old version of what I was when I was 30.
So, yeah, but, okay, do you have old friends in Scotland still, really, really good friends? Or is it like rather schoolmates? Or do you really have good friends?
Yeah, I've got a couple of good friends, let's say, that have been part of my life journey. And I've got, a couple of school friends that would fall into that category as well. But inevitably, your journey of life takes you somewhere else. And, I left Scotland when I was 17. I've always gone back there to visit family and friends. But I've lived 26 years in Monte Carlo. So the 17 years I lived in Scotland was the growing years. It was the childhood years. And the 26 years I've lived in Monaco are adult years where you develop different relationships. And, I have friends around the world that are now, let's say, lifelong adult friends, friends that you just know each other at your core because you've developed as much maybe as you're going to develop. So I wouldn't claim to have a big circle of close friends, but I have a few close friends. And then I have a much wider circle, of course, of people that I've met and enjoy their company. And when we see each other, it's very natural, very relaxed. But we're certainly not, contacting each other every month or something like that. But when we see each other, we're very comfortable in each other's company.
The one question I really would like to know, David, do you think or do you consider racing as dangerous?
I never considered it dangerous, but I know that it's dangerous. So what does that tell you about the way I view danger? I'm risk averse. I never see myself as a risk taker.
So is it rather risk management? And
yes. This,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think that's a good way to say it. So, but I never saw driving the car as, but I think that's a good way to describe it. I'm a risk manager. But the way I saw driving a race car was, it was just a very natural process of going to the limit of the grip that was available and trying to hit apexes, the apex being the perfect point in the corner to make sure that the car meets the curb. So I always thought more as a sort of science project of this is the amount of physical downforce you have, this is the amount of physical grip you have from the compound of tire, this is the track conditions, this is the air temperature. Let's discover how fast you can take this vehicle around the racetrack. So the modern society wants to continue to wrap everything in cotton wool. And I don't want anyone to be injured or anyone to be hurt. That's a tragic end to anyone's life journey, but there's so many sports. You just need to look at skateboarders and mountain bikers. You can go on the social media channels today and you can see hundreds of those people breaking legs, crashing into trees, and they're living with the knowledge that if they make a mistake, they'll hit a tree. In a Grand Prix car or a go-kart, you don't hit a tree unless you're very unlucky. You'd have to leave the circuit to hit a tree. So I think that we're in a much more contained risk environment. And, I started my Formula One career after the death of Ayrton Senna. I never really considered the fact that I would be killed in a race car. I knew I could be, but it never worried me or scared me, because if I was, I wouldn't be around to worry about it. So, you know, I think I'm just a very matter of fact person when it comes to it. And as much as society wants to, as I say, wrap everything in cotton wool, if you look at one of the biggest growing sports of the last 20 years, it's been UFC. It's this ultimate fighting where it really is men and women with very small gloves punching and kicking and headbutting or whatever they're allowed to do their way to success. This is the most raw form of combat, and it's got a huge following, and it shows something in the psyche of a human being. Not everybody, of course, and I'm definitely not a fighter, but something in our psyche is that survival of the fittest, that fight to prove that you are the strongest in your you know, the animal kingdom. It happens very often, you know, the lions fighting to show who's number one or whatever it happens to be. And maybe just we're too intelligent to want to, you know, do that in mass society, but we're also too much animal DNA to completely shake it out of our system.
Well, I was quite amazed because on your website, you actually do this little clip sitting in a 4x4. And what you're saying is, this is beyond my comfort zone. So that didn't really look as dangerous as like going around in 300 kilometers around a circuit.
Yeah, it's just when you do some off-road driving, if you've not done it before to that level, your mind is conflicted, because on one hand you're going, a car is not meant to be in this environment. On the other hand, the people that are organizing these events know the car is capable. So on one hand, I trust them because they don't want anyone to be injured. But on the other hand, it takes you outside of your comfort zone. So again, sort of showing I have a parameter of which I'm comfortable operating. And, you know, outside of that, I would need to learn it to become comfortable. But, you know, I was learning being comfortable in a racing cart and a racing car since I was 11 years old. So I had a lot of practice to be comfortable with it.
Now, after your career finished, you actually became a radio commentator with the BBC. You became entrepreneur. You actually, I don't know, you're not running the hotels, but you've got a business share. Is that rather a challenge, or do you really want to kind of be involved in the hotel industry as well?
Yeah, well, I had an investment in the Columbus Hotel in Monaco for 10 years. I sold my shares, so I'm no longer involved. But part of the motivation was born out of, I was living in Monaco, but I wasn't involved in anything in Monaco other than the Grand Prix, which happened once a year. So I wanted to be part of a journey, part of a business within Monaco. And there was an opportunity to invest in the hotel. It could have been an opportunity to invest in a restaurant or some other business, but that was the one that came along. And it was with a Scottish partnership, which, you know, again, had a connection to my where I'd grown up. And yeah, my belief was, I traveled the world, I spent a lot of time in a lot of different hotels. And for me, what made a great hotel was not whether it had a really comfortable bed or a well-stocked minibar. It was the experience you get from when you enter, from the check-in, when you ask for something. It always comes down to people. So I was always very much, let's say, customer driven. And it comes a little bit, I think, from my parents, the way they operate the transport company. They spend a lot of time dealing with the customers, because my father would always say that, you know, there's 1,000 businesses that can deliver products from point A to point B. So when you do your job at the price that you agreed, people are not going to thank you because that's what was agreed. But when there's a problem, that's when you do customer service. How you deal with that? How do you make the customer feel that you're finding the best and quickest solution? So it was always sort of problem solving was what I was educated that is customer service. And that's the same attitude I took towards the hotel. How do you make this experience the best it can be, accepting that we're not a, you know, 6-star luxury hotel. It was a 3-star hotel. And even little things like, I remember calling the hotel once and they didn't know it was me, but the engagement on the telephone was a little bit not very polite and just not that interested. And I lived only 500 meters from the hotel. So I walked around and I saw who was on duty. And I said, did you just take a call from someone looking to book a table in the restaurant? And they went, yes. And I went, well, you know, it was me. And let me just tell you how that experience was. It didn't really make me feel that.
Sorry to interrupt you. Did you say that in French or in English?
In English, yeah, because I don't speak French. But they were like, oh, look, I'm sorry. I was busy with something else. And I went, well, if you're too busy to do the next thing, don't do two things badly. Do one thing well. So if you're too busy to answer the phone, then we need someone else to answer the phone. But what was it that you were so busy doing? Oh, I was checking a booking for someone else. I said, was there a customer in front of you at the time? And they went, no. And I said, well, therefore, the phone then becomes the priority. But if there is a customer in front of you, the phone is not the priority. Because one thing I don't appreciate, I remember very well going to a hotel in New York, beautiful hotel. And I couldn't get checked in because they kept answering the phone in front of me going, sorry, sorry. And I'm thinking, well, who on the phone is more important than the person that's about to spend money? So, you know, I just think it's part of understanding how to do customer service, make people feel that you care rather than you don't, because if you don't care, why should they care to come back?
No, absolutely right. Yeah. No, thank you very much for that kind of lesson towards customer service as well. In 2010, you became MBE, a member of the Order of the British Empire. What does that mean to you?
Well, in British society, to be recognized by, you know, Buckingham Palace, Her Majesty at that time, we obviously have lost a queen this year, and we now have a king. But to be recognized in that way in society is not welcomed by everyone. I think it was John Lennon from the Beatles declined to receive some sort of recognition from the palace because he had another view on society. But anyway, everyone's allowed their own view on it. But for me, it was through services to sport, and I was very proud because I had the opportunity to take my mother and father to Buckingham Palace. And
did you actually meet the Queen
on that day? No, it was King Charles on that day, but I have met the Queen on other occasions, and I have a nice photograph, actually not here but in my apartment in Monaco, where I'm with the Queen, Ron Dennis from McLaren, and Kimi Räikkönen. And you can tell I'm saying something, I don't know what it was, and the Queen is laughing. And she had a great affinity to Scotland. So maybe it was something about Scotland. And I actually don't remember, because I was quite nervous to meet the Queen, but it's lovely on reflection of what a great public servant she was to imagine that at one moment I was able to make the Queen laugh out of all the many, many people that she'd met on her life's journey. But on that particular occasion, it was Prince Charles, as he was at that time, and you get your medal pinned on your jacket, and you get some photographs at the palace, and yeah, it's a really nice experience.
No, great. So we could go on. I think there's other topics here, supporting social projects like Wings for Life. The last question I really would like to ask you, when you were a boy, and this is what you confessed in your book, It Is What It Is, that you were bulimic when you were a boy. How did you actually handle that? How could that happen? And how did you handle that to get basically cured?
Well, my bulimia was based on, I needed to be a certain weight to race. So a little bit like a jockey on a horse, you hear stories of them going in the sauna and sweating and getting themselves, or boxers getting themselves down to weight. I had to be at a certain weight. And I was already one of the taller drivers when I was in karting. So weight was a problem, and I'd weigh myself in the morning, I'd weigh myself at night. And if I was too heavy, then if I'd had dinner already, then I was in a position where it was very easy for me to make myself regurgitate the food. And I would exercise, and I became obsessive about being on weight, because weight is key to performance. The cure was very simple. When I moved from karting into cars, there was not the same extreme need to be a certain weight. You needed to be light, but the were not weighed as a total package. So that's the point at which it stopped. So mine was not based out of looking at myself in the mirror and going, oh, I'm fat. I was never fat. It was based on the scales telling me my performance would be affected. And for me, it was a way of total commitment. It's clearly not the healthiest way to live. And thankfully, it was only a few years of my life. And it's not part of my life today. I'm carrying a few pounds in my mid-50s. And I kind of feel that's part of the journey. But it was interesting to show, because my parents didn't know. I didn't share it with anyone. But again, it shows if you're totally committed to something, what you're prepared to do to try and achieve your goal.
David, thank you very much indeed. The last insight I would ask you about to give is, what is your final ultimate challenge? You've achieved so much. You're an entrepreneur, like I mentioned. You're a BBC moderator, supporting social project. What is your ultimate challenge, what you still are looking forward to achieve?
Well, I'm in that phase of life now where I have a 14-year-old son and he wants to be a racing driver. So I now feel that I'm here to support him as best I can to try and realize his goal, his dream. Whether he'll be good enough or whether he'll be lucky enough remains to be seen. But it just wouldn't sit comfortably in my mind if I didn't try and support him to the best of my knowledge. And of course, the old expression, you can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make it drink. I can advise him on fitness. I can try and create opportunities. But at the end, he still needs to drive. He needs to make the decisions. He needs to understand that commitment is not what you do when people are there. Commitment is what you do when no one's there to see it. Training and getting sleep and taking care of yourself, that's commitment. And if nothing else, this journey will give him life lessons, which will help him in his future, whether that's in racing, whether it's in business, whether it's in life. So I really believe in the power of sport to educate. And a lot of people that never have made it to the highest level of their chosen sport, but if they've had the commitment to try their very best, still end up having success in their life because they understand the work ethic that's involved. So I feel that that's the let's say the greatest challenge, because I don't know what he thinks. I knew what I was thinking when I was going through all the challenges, but I know what it takes to live the life that I live, but I just don't know what is in his mind. And it's really interesting for me to go from this very selfish me way of living to putting the spotlight or the focus on someone else. And of course, for your children, you would do everything to help them realize the dream, but you also have to be hard to be fair, which means you cannot just give them things and say, well done. You know, you need to show them that they have to work, they have to compete, they have to admire other people's success and want to use that as a catalyst to be better.
David Coulthard, thank you ever so much for your time, for your frankness, your openness, and for your very, very interesting answers.
Thank you.
You very much, David, and hope to see you soon.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Have a good Christmas.
Okay. And you have great Christmas, David. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sollte Ihnen unser Podcast gefallen, können Sie diesen abonnieren auf Spotify, Deezer, Apple oder Google oder auf Ihrer Lieblingsplattform. Fragen und Anregungen gerne an podcast@londonspeakerbureau.de.